After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, visit www.beherenownetwork.com/Sharon. Enjoy listening.
Hi, this is Sharon Salzberg, and I'm delighted to sit down with Lama Tsultram Alyoni for today's episode of the Metta Hour podcast. Lama Tsultram is an author, Buddhist teacher, and the founder and resident Lama of Tara Mandala Retreat Center in Colorado. Lama Tsultram was born in the States and traveled to India in her late teens. We actually met in 1970, or very early 1971, in Bodh Gaya, India, to begin with. In 1970, at the age of 22, she was ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist nun by His Holiness the 16th Karmapa. After 4 years living as a nun in the Himalayan region, she returned her monastic vows, married, and raised a family of 3 children. She has a master's degree in Buddhist studies, women's studies from Antioch University, and is known for her ability to translate the wisdom of the ancient Tibetan Buddhist tradition into clear teachings that are relatable and relevant to Western audiences. Her latest book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine, was released in May of 2018. Welcome.
Thank you, Sharon. Nice to be with you.
It's very nice to be with you. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you. And for you on yours.
Yes. Well, they keep coming, no matter how many books someone has written. I always feel it's like a really big accomplishment, especially I know your schedule is probably like mine in terms of traveling and teaching and a lot of other responsibilities, and you have the place and everything that implies. And so just sort of the quiet time to write a book takes some doing.
Yes, challenging.
Yes. So you first went to India, as I did, in your teens. Can you talk a little bit about the impetus for that journey?
I went to India when I was 19. I had dropped out of university, and I was interested in what I called the Mystic East, and it was 1967 that I went. And so it was definitely with an idea of search that I went. Mm-hmm. I didn't go as a tourist. And so I was with Vicki Hitchcock, who was the director of Blessings and When the Iron Bird Flies. I don't know if you know that, but mm-hmm. she and I were friends.
I didn't know that. That's really amazing.
Yeah. We were college friends, and we went together. And her father was a consul general in Calcutta at that time. And so we worked with Mother Teresa for a while in a home for unwed mothers and abandoned babies, and then went to Nepal, and that's where I met Tibetans. And for me, it was like an amazing process of kind of like trying to remember a song that you once knew when I saw them. It was very familiar, mm-hmm. and yet, of course, very foreign, because I was from New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and they were from Tibet and had just escaped. So a very paradoxical feeling of, these are my people, but I'm not one of them, mm-hmm. but I am one of them. mm-hmm. So that was my first impression.
You know, this is going to sound really strange, but I was reading something online of Michael Pollan's recent book about his first taking psychedelics at whatever age he is now. And the things he was describing didn't make me think of psychedelics. They made me think of living in India in those years. You know, the quality of discovery and the sense of wonder and love and looking at very ordinary experience with new eyes and just feeling like the movement of life, you know, through everything. And so I look back just recently, this just happened like yesterday or something. And so I started thinking again about what it was like to be in India in those young years and, you know, being so sick or whatever. And none of it mattered.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if it was like that for you, but the sense of connectedness to sacred places and even there being a sacred place, we didn't have that in New Hampshire, you know?
Yeah.
And so like being at the Swambhu Stupa in Kathmandu or in Bodh Gaya was an extraordinary awakening to the whole idea of sacred place and that there was such a thing. We had a very divorced relationship with nature. You know, we lived in houses and, you know, I lived in the country and was in nature a lot, but my parents didn't really relate to it except to sort of somewhere where you go and do things like ride horses or play golf or whatever. And that was really important to me, and also the connection to the lunar cycle, that there were things that happened on full moon and new moon. I never conceived of something like that. Plus, India was very different in those days. There were, I think, something like 6 billion less people.
You're right.
Something like that there are now. I don't know if that statistic's right, but there are many fewer people. And very few cars. You hardly ever see cars on the road. You'd see elephants and camels and trucks, and then the odd ambassador, those weird kind of sedans that had curtains in the window.
Yeah, I remember those.
But, you know, so when I hitchhiked across India in 1967, riding on the top of trucks mostly on that box that's over the cab of the truck, it was like a two-story convertible. And looking out over the plains of India and sleeping up there and then waking up in the morning and, you know, watching people going out into the fields with their tools and so on. And just the life, the rhythm of life was so connected to nature and sacredness. And that was really new to me.
And it strikes me that, you know, in some ways, that sense of the sacred in the ordinary and the sense of that magic that's discoverable, that's real, and to be experienced actually permeates your work. Like a large portion of Wisdom Rising is the teaching of the different forms of the Dakini, which is almost an exemplar of that coming together. And so for those who aren't familiar with that lineage, can you speak a little bit on the context you're drawing from and what a Dakini is and how they became such an integral part of your practice?
Yeah, so as I said, I followed the Tibetan tradition, which is Vajrayana Buddhism. It was the final period of development of Buddhism in India that occurred between the 8th and 12th centuries mainly. And it is a very interesting thing that happened to Buddhism because there was a huge influx of new ideas and practices and so on when the tantric tradition joined with Buddhism. And so what came in were mandalas. There were sadhana practices with visualizations, mantras, hand movements, mudras, feasting, poetry, sacred sexuality, and women teachers, women gurus, which was a new phenomena. And so within this context of Vajrayana Buddhism, which then joined with Mahayana Buddhism, forming what we call Vajrayana or Tantrayana or Mantrayana. I somewhat avoid the word Tantra because it's so associated with Neo-Tantra.
Mm-hmm.
Now in this country, and Tantra really has such a deeper meaning. It actually means continuity, a luminous thread of continuity. But in any case, within the Tibetan tradition that I practiced, I met this concept of the sacred feminine in the form of Dakinis. And they look sort of like human beings, but they're different colors, and they don't have, you don't see them as having intestines and hearts and mm-hmm. so on. They're made of light, and different colors of light that have different symbolic meanings, and they have accoutrements that have symbolic meanings, and they're fierce, and they're surrounded by flames. And so when you practice a Dakini mandala, you actually are transforming your own psyche into a template of wholeness, the mandala, which has a center and four directions. So it has the central Dakini, and Dakini is in the four directions, and they're dancing, they're luminous, and they're fierce and wise. And so this whole idea of fierce wisdom, or an aspect of the feminine that was more wild and had a sense of sexuality and spirituality sort of co-emerging in the Dakinis, but mainly that this fierce wisdom and how they appear as guides and messengers, and they are deities as well. So for me, this was a very refreshing option in terms of the feminine and what the sacred feminine could mean or could be embodied as. And I had the experience, of course, of the Virgin Mary, although I wasn't raised Catholic. I was raised Unitarian, but I knew about that and the Greek goddesses and so on, but I hadn't had this experience of these very fascinating emanations of wisdom called Dakinis.
Mm-hmm.
And in Sanskrit, it's Dakinis, and in Tibetan, it's Khandro, or Khandro Ma, which means it's called sky dancer, or she who goes through space or travels in space. Does that give you an idea?
Yeah, no, I'm sitting here all enraptured. It's great. And each Dakini, you write about five different families of Dakinis mm-hmm. in the book, and each is related to a different quality of wisdom, right?
Yeah, no, and interestingly, also a different obstructed emotional pattern.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And so each Dakini, for example, in the center you have the Buddha Dakini, and her obstructed emotional pattern, or her poison, as it would be called, is ignorance. And so that takes the form of denial, depression, spaciness, and so on. And then that very energy, when the grip of ego is removed from it, the same energy becomes spaciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all-encompassing wisdom. So each Dakini has this, in a way, it's almost like a shrouded energy
mm-hmm.
in the poison. And then through the illumination due to the sound of the seed syllable and the light and the visualization, that obstructed pattern is transformed into the wisdom.
Yeah, I love that. In the Theravadan system, like in Burma or Southeast Asia, there's kind of a similar construct, not with Dakinis, but with just mental qualities where, you know, there's a personality type known as the aversive type, as an example, the kind of person who only sees pretty much what's wrong when they walk uh-huh. into a room. And the obstructed or constricted limitation of that is that you're perpetually unhappy. And you miss a lot of what's joyous and delightful. But the purified form of that very same tendency is a kind of penetrating insight, because that ability to see what's wrong is also a rare gift. There are lots of groups where no one else wants to see that flaw, you know, or that hole in the carpet or whatever. And here's this person saying, look at that hole, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they can cut through like social niceties and so on.
Yeah. 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 That's very similar. And also in the five families, anger or aversion becomes mirror-like wisdom, mm-hmm. which is that quality of clarity and insight. That's very similar.
It's beautiful. So this is a quotation from your book. The loss of feminine qualities is an urgent psychological and ecological issue in modern society. It is a painful loss in our emotional lives and a disastrous loss for the safety of life on Earth. So what do you mean by feminine qualities? I'm assuming loving kindness and compassion and so on.
Yeah, yes, and but not only.
Mm-hmm.
I think feminine qualities have a variety of manifestations. Some are the more obvious ones that we associate with with kindness, compassion, an experience of interconnectedness, a relationality, valuing of relation, and also the feminine has the quality of insight and precision and wisdom. So in Vajrayana Buddhism, the feminine is associated with wisdom and the masculine with skillful means and compassion. So that wisdom energy is connected also with emptiness, not empty like empty pocket, but the emptiness of the experience of letting go of our reified notions of things and how they are, and then that being transformed into its true condition. So that idea of emptiness connected to the feminine doesn't mean like, oh, it's women are empty, you know,
right.
they're nothing, but more that vastness and then how that manifests is in the Dakinis and in the female yidams or deities, and also in women and women teachers and so on.
In many ways, I think you are possibly most well known for your work with the shadow and feeding your demons. I remember, I can't remember what year it was, when I went to Cambridge, Mass. To sit as a student in one of your weekend retreats, we were doing chid practice, feeding the demons. I remember.
I didn't know you did that.
I did that, yeah. And we took a walk afterwards, and we got completely lost in the cemetery. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
It. We just wandered around. It's like I wrote about it, which is why I remembered it. But it was really interesting. We ended up just wandering and wandering and wandering. They locked up. You know, we couldn't get out. And then finally, the caretaker came. And, of course, he had no one normally to talk to. So he talked, like, endlessly before he let us out, you know. But it's quite interesting wandering through the cemetery.
Well, that's very traditional, you know, Dakinis wandering in the charnel ground.
Yes, there we were, and having done chid practice. So maybe you could say something about the shadow and feeding your demons.
Sure, yeah. Two main things I think I focused on, and in a way they have a similar theme. One is the chid practice and how that then was made accessible through my five-step process of feeding your demons. And then the mandala and the transformation of emotions into wisdom with that template. So feeding your demons is based on the idea that those parts of ourselves that drain us, which are our addictions, the things we're worried about, our fixations, our fears, and so on, those are our demons. They're not external beings at all. Machi Lopton, who founded the Chid practice, said all demons come from the mind. So our demons are, I guess you could say simply, our hang-ups. It's what drains our energy. And so the principle behind feeding them is that rather than trying to repress these things, let's say it's an addiction, rather than just trying to stop we look at and transform that energy of the addiction into a personified being and then ask it what it wants, what it really needs, and how it will feel if it gets what it really needs.
Mm-hmm.
So under an addiction, for example, there's always some sort of need that you're trying to fill. Maybe mm-hmm. you want to feel comfort or whatever. So with feeding your demons, you address that and you actually turn your own body into a nectar, and that nectar has the quality that the demon will feel if it gets what it really needs, and that's what you feed them. And so essentially what happens is that alienated part of the psyche, or that piece that you're ashamed of or that you try to repress or get rid of, is brought forth, accepted, nurtured, and then integrated. And so in a way, it's a similar process with the mandala, because you're, again, working with the shadow and the negative emotions, and then through other kinds of means, through the sound and the color and the visualization of the mandala, those negative patterns or the shadow energy of the five poisons is transformed into the five wisdoms.
So in both cases, it seems that it's an antidote to fear and shame, as you say, you know, like the more conventional reactions to these states that we don't like, we don't want to believe are still there after all these years of practice or therapy or life or whatever. And yet they are. Certainly they're arising, although perhaps not in quite the same form, but they are present. And so we struggle often with that sense of revulsion and dismay, you know, like what's this still here for? And so they're really practices, it seems to me, about fearlessness, our own ability to be with.
Be with and feed and nurture mm-hmm. those parts of ourselves that we wish weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, those parts can integrate.
Mm-hmm.
And we come into an experience of wholeness, rather than being in a state of battling with ourselves all the time.
Mm-hmm. It seems also that structurally, like, different systems in society exist because it's too uncomfortable to sit and integrate some painful feelings. So we project, you know, we create the other that will bear the rage and the be the holder of the greed or whatever we imagine, you know, or project onto someone
else.
That's
right, yeah. Yeah, we work with ourselves. And, you know, even when you work, say, with a relationship with feeding your demons, you don't feed the other person as the demon. You work with what comes up in you in the context of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. I just got a very funny image of, you know,
of the other person as the demon.
The other person as the demon, like all those empty chairs populated by people's partners and so on. It was really cute.
I just yesterday taught, it was Sunday, taught at Spirit Rock a retreat, a day long called Demons in Love. It was specifically about the demons that come up in relationship.
Uh-huh.
And how great relationship is for triggering our demons.
I bet it was a great day and very popular.
it was interesting. Yeah.
It was really fabulous. So I'm going to ask you one of the questions that people ask me all the time about Buddhism and inequality. And people are always asking me if I felt personally that a loss in some way, or, you know, secondary in my life within the Buddhist context. And for me, my response is like, I've never felt that in any way in terms of my access to teachings or teachers or the things that I was really there for. That there is there's clearly a patriarchal structure that exists in Southeast Asia, so that, I'd have... say teachers, monk teachers say to me, one other thing was I had very few monastic teachers till later on, but and I never became a nun. So I never actually entered the kind of heart of the hierarchy and the places I would really feel discrimination. But as a lay woman and a teacher, you know, it would be kind of, I don't know what the right word is in English. It's sort of like I'd have a monk say to me, in terms of learning loving kindness meditation and being about to bring it back to the U.S. because within that tradition, I was the first one. And you know, this monk said to me, "You'll be a very fine teacher of loving kindness for women." And I thought, well, it doesn't work that way, you know. So there's definitely that, you know. But not having become a nun, I don't feel like I really had to. I could sort of do exactly what actually they told me to do in the spirit of the original teachings, which was take what was useful and leave the rest.
Yeah. It's definitely something. We also had a different experience being Western. Mm-hmm. That I realized, you know, that I felt, oh, I was never really, there wasn't prejudice against me. I got all the teachings I wanted and so on. Mm-hmm. But I realized I was treated differently than, say, a Tibetan nun.
Mm-hmm.
And like there was a nun who was at the place of Abba Rinpoche, who was one of my primary meditation teachers in the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
A married lama, and he had kids and a wife and so on. And there was a nun there, and all she did was cook and clean.
Mm-hmm.
And she had renounced the world in order to practice the Dharma. But, you know, that was what she ended up doing because she was a woman, and it was considered that she didn't have the capacity to do more than that. And so I think it's a little slanted for us, mm-hmm, as Westerners to think that this was all the women's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And because it wasn't and isn't still. But I do think that our experience as Western women teachers is also impacting Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And women are being treated differently, partly because of the teachers coming to the West and realizing, oh, women can drive. Oh, women can do this and women can do that. Oh, and women are actually smart and they're running these centers.
Right.
There's a 90% of women at this retreat, you know. And so realizing, you know, the qualities of women here and then implementing change back there. But it's slow, mm-hmm, moving, and it's also that women have internalized the definition of themselves as inferior,
mm-hmm,
and as a lower birth. And I know I've had the conversation here in the Bay Area with somebody who is involved with domestic violence amongst Tibetan, mm-hmm, resettlement projects,
mm-hmm,
and how the women have internalized the idea that when they're abused, this is because of their bad karma,
mm-hmm,
and being born a woman is already their bad karma, and the abuse is just part of it, and so they should pray to be reborn as a man. And the women think this. You, mm-hmm, know, they've internalized that message. That shift, it will take time, and hopefully it will happen, and those images, self-images, will change.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been one of the amazing things about watching this movement of these teachings from Asia to the West. I mean, not that the West is perfect by any means, but just the kind of conviction. Like, I remember one at the Insight Meditation Society, which is a center I co-founded in Massachusetts, you know, different teachers come and go. And there was one year, many years ago, when one of the Western teachers had gone to Thailand, I think it was, and had really been very taken with this Thai meditation teacher and brought him back to co-lead a retreat with him. And we were sitting up in one of the rooms and getting ready to leave, just when I were going to leave. And we didn't have a house in those days, so when there was like a, while the rooms were taken up in the center, we had to go somewhere else. So we we're getting ready to leave, and we're just having a conversation. He said something. I don't even know what inspired it, but he said, well, you know, of course, if you're a woman, the best thing to do is to take care of the monks and make merit, because then maybe in your next life you can be reborn a man, and then you can be liberated. I took a look at the Westerner who invited him, who was going to be there for 2 weeks with him, and I thought, good luck with that, you know. Like, and I left, and I came back 2 weeks later, and of course he was like completely like pale, you know, and like, you know, exhausted, and like, because it's not easy, you know. It's just not going to work. I mean, it's not going to fly here, you know. There isn't going to be a passive acceptance of it, and so hence is the transformation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, the interdependence of the shift. I was in a car once with a Tibetan Lama, and his sister was in the back seat with Aunt Klein, and I was talking about women and the nuns and so on, and how they weren't getting the full education and so on that they should be getting. And he started to say things like, well, you know, that's how it's always been, and, you know, the nuns just don't have that same capacity, and you know, I will get really severely criticized if I change it, and so on. That was his real worry. And I was, like, not letting him off the hook, and I just kept going, like, no, Rinpoche, no, you have to make this shift, otherwise it's never going to change, and so on. And his sister was in the back seat, not saying anything, but pinching Anne Klein's thigh really hard. Like, she was so excited.
Well, that's very funny. So how is the reception to Wisdom Rising, given the context of this time?
Well, it's amazing how it just keeps becoming more timely. The message of the book, with, of course, we've had the Women's March, and then Me Too, and Time Is Up, and now within Buddhism itself, there's a whole sort of new wave of Me Too movement happening, and so there's that level of its relevance, because I do talk about that. The way that women and nature have been tied together historically and in past, of the emphasis is transcendence, then women and nature are always at the bottom and the divine is at the top, and so they're denigrated and so on. And so I've taught about that parallel of our ecological situation and the situation of women, and how the religious rules and values that are governing world religions, all of them, are repressive to women and also to nature. And how we don't really talk enough about how we need to shift those religious values in order for the fundamental paradigm of people's lives to shift, to have that outer shift in terms of how we're treating the earth and how we're treating women. And so that's very current, obviously. And then the methods in the book are important, because as women are waking up and as they're experiencing their fierceness, they're looking for methods of empowerment, empowerment, so that they're not drained in terms of their activism or the changes they're trying to support. And so the reception has been extraordinary, and it's very almost eerie how timely the book is, and how unplanned that was. You know, but it just feels like it's part of the change that's upon us, and I'm happy about it. I've been talking about this, as you know, for probably 40 years. I'm not exaggerating. And so to actually see some of these shifts, even though it's painful for these things to come out, it's it's important, and it gives me hope for the future that we can actually see a shift.
I think, who knows what guides these things and the timing, you know, it's like, it's such an amazing thing, but the timing does feel extraordinary. And it's also interesting, you know, knowing, you have a family, knowing younger people that they just see the world differently. You know, the things we struggle over sometimes, like, gender identity and, you know, how to reveal something about yourself to your to society. You know, it's like they just think, what? You know, where there are people like that. There are people with two male parents or people with two female parents. Mm-hmm. It's just like, hey, that's just life, you know? And so
and 40
years has seen a lot of change.
Recent.
Yes.
You know, that whole acceptance of gay marriage and having parents of the same gender, that's really short. And of course, it's not complete, you know? Mm-hmm. Might seem like it is because so much change has happened, but it's still very much in process, and there's still a lot of prejudice and a lot of unacceptance of it, as we know.
Oh, definitely. And there's, there's something about just time going by, you know, and new generations. Yeah. And somebody had a, when Steve Jobs died, somebody posted a, thing online about I don't know how old their child was, like under two, and they handed him an iPad, and he was very happy, like flipping the, you know, moving the pages. They handed him a magazine, and he freaked out because it was static. Huh. And his young mind, the magazine was like a broken iPad, you know,
right?
That wouldn't move anything. Look at that, you know.
Wow.
We are changing. Well, thank goodness for change too. Really. In its own way. So here's another quotation from your book. If I could find the Dakinis, I would find my spiritual role models. I could see how they did it. I could see how they made the connections between mother, wife, and woman, how they integrated spirituality with everyday life challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And you found the Dakinis.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I found them, and then I really developed a relationship with them, and I did for about 8 years every day and doing numerous retreats and so on, this one practice, which is the Gong Ter, the mind treasure of Ayukandro, and it's a Siamukha practice, which is the lion-headed Dakini.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the four Dakinis around her and the same symbols, and then there's 16 retinue Dakinis and then four gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that so intensely and so much. It's almost like I felt like I had gone to the realm of the Dakinis because I was there so much with them. And so I have a very personal feeling about them. And I guess you could say I believe they do have an ontological existence. They're not just archetypes and symbolic, although I think that for most people that's a big stretch, and it's more useful to think about them as symbolizing certain qualities, transformations, and so on. But my personal experience is much more alive than that.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. I'm so glad you said that, too, about practice, because we also live in a time of, not all change is positive, of course, you know, and we live in a time of, like, the one-minute meditator or, you know.
Yeah.
Where practice, I mean, somebody, I tell this story sometimes in teaching, I was teaching in New York, and somebody very uncharmingly said to me, well, a lot of younger meditation teachers than you say we don't need to formally practice at all. We can just be mindful, like walking down the street or, you know, cooking dinner or whatever. So what do you have to say? You know, so in my dotage, you know, I said, I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a nice story and it's theoretically very true, but is it real for any one of us? You know, would I actually be that mindful stirring the rice and walking down the street if I didn't have a formal practice. I don't think so.
Yeah. One of the things that I say to that is it's very difficult to have the post-meditation experience without the meditation experience.
Mm-hmm. It's great. Yeah, well, it's an interesting landscape, you know, in, you know, the things we value, compassion, mindfulness, whatever, also meeting the West in these other ways, you know. Let's hurry up. It's taking too long. It's too much effort.
Yeah, it's too bad because it's going to lead to degeneration of the tradition, and it's going to be like, oh, yeah, I know meditation. I have the app.
Great.
You know? And, you know, for us who have met so many amazing teachers of the generation before us and experienced those beings, and really they are beings. Of course, they're human, but they're such extraordinary beings like Dzenge Kensei Rinpoche and Tuku Urgyen and Kala Rinpoche and my teacher Abba Rinpoche and so on, Dzogchen Rinpoche, and of course the holiness of Dalai Lama we still have with us. But yeah, those beings that spent 12 years in retreat or 16 years. And now we have it at Taramandala, which is my center in Colorado, and Pagosa Springs, as you know. We have a Lama who spent 16 years in solitary retreat and then 10 more years in the same cave community guiding others. And I was so happy to meet him because even in the Tibetan communities, very few people are actually doing that. So it's amazing to be with him. He's so radiant. And his name is Lama Karma.
That's nice.
Very simple, you know, background, not, you know, not a tulku, not a reincarnate lama who sits on thrones and things and really spent that much time in practice. This is becoming more and more rare. And it's also why next year I'm going into retreat myself and not going to be traveling around or doing things like this. I'll teach at Taramandala some in the summer and spring, but I plan to take a deep dive into my own practice because as teachers, I think we can also get equally busy and distracted and try to fit in practice amongst all that. We lose that thread of our own development and deepening, which is essential as teachers to have.
Well, it's very inspiring, and really, it's great. I got off an airplane at I don't know what time last night. I got back to my apartment in New York at 2 a.m. You know, because the plane was late, and I got up this morning. You know, and it's just kind of like, oh right, I remember those days. You know, like right, and you weren't getting on another airplane. So how wonderful that you're doing that. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and I know you do a lot of practice, too.
I don't do enough, so this is inspiring me.
Good.
So before we finish, maybe you could say something about Taramandala and the kinds of offerings that are there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Taramandala is in southwest Colorado. It's 700 acres of rolling hills and springs and ponds, and there's wild horses actually now living at Taramandala. Appeared in the last year or so. So as you walk around, wild horses are wandering around too. And there's a 12,000 square foot, three-story temple that was ornamented by Bhutanese carvers and Tibetan artists. So it's extraordinarily beautiful, that the temple. And then it has a Tibetan and English library in the second floor. And then on the third floor is an empty meeting room space, so it's representing the three kayas, the temple. And then we have retreat cabins for solitary retreat. We have people in retreat for as long as 5 years and as short as a few days. So we have group retreats taught by me and other teachers, and hopefully you again sometime soon.
Someday.
And then Toramundo's also become more active online.
Mm-hmm.
We finally got internet up and down. We had like a miserable internet for years, and just last November we got really good internet, so we can webcast and do things that way, which is really helpful. So we also have online courses. There's an online course launching August 1st on Wisdom Rising, and there's a Feeding Your Demons course online. And then the other thing is that I'm active on Lama Sultram Alione Facebook page, mm-hmm. the public figure page. I've got a private one, but I now have 5,000 close friends, so I'm not allowed to have any more. So we have the public page, and we do a lot of live webcasting on Facebook. And, it's pretty active there.
That's so great. I mean, the first time I went, I slept in a tent.
Right.
Which
that's
was,
all there was.
You know, that's all there was. And so it was actually interesting and fine. I'm a very urban person, but it was fine, except when I had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and I turned around, I couldn't remember which tent was mine, but that was a moment. But, and then when Sonny Rinpoche was suggesting that, you know, I should go back, and I said, well, of course I will, but, you know, it's they don't have any internet. And they laughed at me because you had built, in the meantime, this extraordinary temple and structure, and you had internet at all, which was a big step.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that much more heartening to hear that.
Well, now it's fast.
Yeah.
It's really, it really was kind of like coming out of the dark ages. Although there's a beauty, too, to no internet being on the land. And, you know, I think, in a way, the theme of our conversation today has been this play between the ancient tradition and the beauty of those teachers and teachings,
mm-hmm.
and actually really not losing that.
Yeah.
At the same time, how can we meet our world as it is now and have an impact and help more people? And things like meditation apps do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
So it's a balancing act, and everyone has to choose the way they're going to relate to that. But, you know, to me, the most important thing is to help people, and not only people, but, of course, animals and so on, all beings. And so however we can do that best, we should use the skillful means to do it.
It's fantastic. And I wonder if you could lead us in a meditation for a few minutes just before we close.
Yeah, maybe what we could do is to try one of the seed syllables of the Dakinis with the color and feel the transformation of an emotion, and do just a short meditation like that.
Great.
So let's take the emotion of anger. I think it's something that's coming up for a lot of us now, and we're seeing the changes that are happening in our world and so on. So whether it's personal anger or more collective upset over things that are happening, let's tune into how we each experience anger, perhaps recalling an incident that happened recently. And now, staying in touch with that, feeling where in our body we locate anger and what the texture of it's like, what the feeling is like in our bodies. And then we'll use the seed syllable for the Vajra family, which is governed by the obstructed pattern of wisdom and the wisdom pattern of mirror-like wisdom, and it works with anger. So we'll use the seed syllable Ha, H-A, and the color blue. It's blue light, and so we'll sound the Ha, and sound it as though we're sending the sound inside our bodies rather than projecting it out, and see the blue light of Vajra family permeating our bodies, and watch what happens to the anger when we do that. So first, tuning into the anger. And now together sounding the seed syllable ha, H-A. And as we sound that, sending blue light through our bodies and noticing what happens. Feeling the luminosity of the blue in our bodies, pure light, and emanating mirror-like wisdom, the clarity of the mind like a mirror. And noticing how that feels in our bodies. Noticing also what happened to the anger. Feeling the blue. And then we'll end with dedication of merit, which is the offering of any positive energy that we've accumulated through doing the practice, offering that out to all beings everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me today and for such a rich conversation. To learn more about Lama Sultram's work and the Tara Mandala Center, you can visit www.taramandala.org. That's TARAMANDALA.org. And I also highly recommend her new book, Wisdom Rising, which you can purchase in paperback, ebook, and audiobook formats. And all the places that books are sold. Mm-hmm. Take care.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Sharon's many offerings and her ongoing teaching schedule, please visit her website at sharonsalzberg.com.